So I don't know whether anyone here reads the London Review of Books, but I'm very keen on the London Review of Books. And there's a kind of tradition in the London Review of Books that the reviewers sort of compete with each other how long they can write about something before they actually mention the book they're reviewing. And some reviewers manage to get right to the end of the review before they actually mention the book that they're reviewing. So my talk might feel a little bit in that spirit. I promise, get to Avalokiteshvara, but it might feel a bit like the London Review of Books, yeah. just to warn you. So what I want to do basically is tell you three anecdotes from my own life, and then I want to draw out what I see as the spiritual principles or the spiritual aspects of those experiences that I've had. Not particularly grand experiences, and I'm not trying to particularly draw attention to my own experience. It's more just for me as I have to think through the concrete. I'm not an abstract thinker. I have to sort of see something that's happened to me and then see what that might mean about the Dharma, if you see what I mean. So I'm only using my experience to explore the Dharma. I'm not particularly drawing I don't want to draw attention to my experience as any particularly special. I don't think it is. It's just probably very like your own experience, and I need to think from my experience up, if you see what I mean. Yeah. And what I hope to do in the talk is tell you these three anecdotes and go from my experience up, hopefully, to Avalokiteshvara. Yeah. That's my hope. So, the three anecdotes I want to tell, they follow my early biography of getting involved in the Triratna Buddhist Order and movement, and in a way there'll be a bit of a prequel tomorrow night where we'll hear some personal stories about people's involvement in the Dharma. So I want to talk about, first of all, going to art school. So I went to art school when I was 23, I think, 23 or 24. I went to Goldsmiths Art School in Brixton. I was in the same year as Sarah Lucas. I got to know Sarah Lucas quite well. Damien Hirst was in the year after me. Fiona Ray was in my year. A lot of the YBAs were in either my year or around. Ian Davenport was in the year after me and so on. It was a very highly conceptual college. I think it still is. I think even unpleasantly conceptual in a certain sort of way. It was a very, very competitive environment. Some of my friends at art school really thrived in that environment. I collapsed in that environment. I don't do very well in competitive, highly conceptual environments. I found it very, very difficult. I was very unhappy at art school, at least at first. And after being at art school for 2 years, I came along to the London Buddhist Centre. I cycled from my squat in Brixton to the Wednesday class and learned to meditate. And as soon as I was taught the mindfulness of breathing, I knew I was a Buddhist and that I always had been a Buddhist and that I always would be a Buddhist. And the first thing I noticed, well, apart from the fact that I couldn't meditate for toffee, I used to arrive every Wednesday night. I'd sort of do a forward roll into the shrine room because I was always late cycling from Brixton. And then as soon as they rang the bell, I just fall asleep. And that happened for about a year, I think. So meditation itself had almost no effect on me, really. The first thing I noticed was a change in my artwork. So I'd been trying to work in the atmosphere of Goldsmiths, which is highly conceptual, highly self-conscious in a certain sort of way, highly concerned with critical theory, with all the current theories around. And I didn't do very well in that environment. And just one day, for some reason, not long after I'd been meditating for a while, I went to the college shop and I bought a little tiny sketch pad of coloured paper, which was already a bit of a breakthrough. Goldsmith colour. So recherche. Anyway. And I bought these sort of coloured wax pencil things, and I went to the park, and I'd started listening to music again. I started to listen to classical music again. And I, for some reason, I decided I wanted to listen to Tristan and Isolde, I don't know whether you know Tristan Isolde. When I first heard it, it sounded like for about half an hour a woman screams, and then a man screams for about half an hour, and then they scream together for about half an hour. But somehow I thought that was a good thing to sort of subject myself to. And I remember I sat in the park with my Sony Walkman, as we had in those days, and doing these little drawings of the trees in the park. And I experienced this incredible joy drawing these trees in the park and listening to Tristan and Isolde. And it felt like a new beginning for me. It hadn't come consciously out of my meditation, but I think it had come out of my perception of already being a Buddhist, that it freed something for me, which I can't quite describe. But what I did, I took these little drawings back to my studio, and interestingly, my one tutor, I had some very, very good tutors, particularly one who was completely out of place in Goldsmiths. She was a very, very lovely, warm-hearted woman. And sorry, that does sound like criticism, and it is a criticism. And she immediately recognised that, this is something real here. And I remember I tried to turn one into a painting, and I was painting it for ages and ages and getting really frustrated with it. And I remember, as often happened in my paintings, I'd end up in the bottom right-hand corner. I don't know whether you've ever painted, but there's something particularly problematic about the bottom right-hand corner. And I was particularly moving this blob, which was supposed to be a bush, but it was also a blob. And I was trying to get the blob in the right place, moving it slightly to the left, moving it slightly to the right. And then suddenly I did. It was suddenly in the right place. And when I did that, the painting came alive. Suddenly, something else entered the painting. And that was an immediate sense that the painting had now done its job. And I remember looking at it for ages, sitting and looking at it for ages, trying to think, what's happened here? So it was obviously me. Every mark on the painting was done by me. I'd spent ages working on it, reworking. I remember, I think one of the big decisions, I remember scraping off all the top of the painting where all the trees were and putting more sky back in. And that seemed to solve one problem, but there still had the problem of the bottom right-hand corner. As soon as I just moved it just slightly to the left, suddenly the whole, it was like, I don't know, it's a puzzle that suddenly fitted together and sort of shone back at me. And although I'd done every aspect of it, every mark, there was something in it that I didn't recognise. It was both incredibly familiar to me, incredibly intimate to me, and yet there was some new element in it that I didn't recognise. So I'm going to come back to that story and try and tease out some of the implications of that experience in a minute. But just to leave you with that idea that there was something new had come into the painting, and I thought that something uncanny had happened. That the moment before I got the bush right, it was still not working, and suddenly the painting worked. And it working suddenly meant it was more than me. Yeah. Then just moving on to my first retreat experience, I went, on my first retreat, I went to the men's retreat centre in Norfolk, Padmaloka. Now, I was, one of the marks of my life, one of the defining characters of my life has been fear. I've been a very fearful person for much of my life. Yes, I was a very unhappy boy, a very unhappy boy and a very unhappy adult, really. Yeah, basically. So that covers most of it, doesn't it? I'm hoping for a blissful old age. I've amused myself. So one of the causes for my unhappiness, and this isn't the only cause, and it's not a cause that I sort of blame particularly, but I was consistently and sort of persistently bullied, both at school and at home. So I've got three older brothers who are much, much bigger than me, and they really did bully me ongoingly for many, many years. And I was also very bullied at school. I didn't do very well at school. I was academically very poor, and the form I was in was very, very rough indeed, and I was consistently bullied. So it was a horrible year-in, year-out experience of being bullied at school and then bullied at home when I got home. Now, for instance, it was only in my early... a holiday I went into when I was about 22 or something. when I suddenly realised you could actually enjoy a holiday. Until then, the holidays were a kind of ordeal, because it was with me and my brothers all the time, and they'd just take it out of me all the time. So I got to this, it's interesting, I did want to go on a men's retreat, because I did somehow want to face up to my feelings about men. I felt very complicated about men, for all kinds of reasons. The retreat was led by Surata, who is a very impressive man. He was obviously much younger then. This is when I was 24. He's a very sporty man, a very extrovert man, a very athletic man, basically very like my brothers. And I immediately didn't like him. I used to do yoga with him, and he's got this particular way of doing yoga, and I really didn't like him. Despite being rather a fragile creature, I was also strangely outspoken. So I asked to talk to him, and he said, yeah, that's fine. And we went and sat on the lawn, and I said, yeah, what did you want to say? And I said, well, I just find that I hate you. In the interest of openness, you know, as you do. Please don't mimic me in this, please. The team don't appreciate it. So I just said, well, I hate you. Yeah. And what he did, which even now, however many, 24 years later, he just said, why do you hate me? And as soon as he said why, in that particular tone of voice, which was just interested, neither taking it terribly personally, nor defensive, nor aggressive, just, oh gosh, why? And as soon as he said why, I just thought, I haven't a clue, I've got no reason to hate you. I don't even know you. it's like, it really was like the sort of scales fell from my eyes. And I just thought, but I don't even know you, I don't know why I hate you. What an absurd thought. But what he did is he then just looked at me. So we've all done the communication exercise, and he just sort of, we just sat there on the lawn. I said, I'm sorry, I don't know why. I'm sorry, I don't know why I've said that even. I don't really quite know what's been going on. Because I had felt it very strongly. So he just looked at me, and, I had this kind of really strong emotional experience of all my complexity, I suppose, around men, around my brothers, around my father. Just sort of evoked. I can't really. The nearest I've ever got to describing it was like a sort of avalanche, but going the other way. I just felt this incredible, tumultuous sort of turning around of my heart. And I still feel really grateful for him now. And he just looked at me. I think I wept and just sort of sat there and felt all this feeling that I didn't even know I had, and I didn't know was behind my what I said to him. So that's my second anecdote. The third anecdote is much later, well, not that much later, but 2 or 3 years later when I was ordained. So I went on the ordination retreat in Spain for 4 months, and you're ordained in the middle of the ordination retreat, so it's a very intensive retreat. It's not unlike this, really. You have this program that goes on, and the next day is meditation and so on. And one of the things I decided to do was write a puja, my own puja, to mark my ordination. And I wanted my puja, my ritual, to ordain as much of me as possible so that every part of my life was included in my ordination. So I wanted to confess things in my puja to people that I'd hurt in my life, not just abstractly, but by that we're using their names and directly. I wanted to rejoice in my parents. I wanted to rejoice in my brothers even. I wanted to rejoice in my life. I wanted to thank people in my imagination and so on. So I wrote this puja for the weeks that preceded my ordination. And then you have this private ordination, you're ordained by your private preceptor, and then in those days they used to leave you alone for the night. You'd just be in this little hut on your own in the night. And you'd just been given your name. I've just been given my name, Maitreya Bandhu. And what I did is I decided that I would recite this puja after my ordination. So my preceptor went back to the retreat centre and I recited my puja, my sevenfold puja that I'd written in the preceding month. It wasn't a marvellous piece of work. It wasn't publishable, I can tell you. I just recited it. And then at the end of reciting it, I had this sort of vision of reality. I seemed to, for a moment, just see things how they really are. In Buddhism, you'd call this a sort of a glimpse of perfect vision. And it was undeniable, if you see what I mean. It wasn't something I thought up, it wasn't an idea. Before it happened, I had no sense of being in a particularly sensitive state or a particularly exalted state. All I remember in my ordination itself is I was very, very nervous. And I remember thinking, this is very, very important. I was just so nervous. I could hardly sort of relax. So it wasn't that I was in a great state. But there you go. Suddenly, I finished my puja. I sort of closed the book that I'd written. And the universe sort of opened up to me. The best way I can describe it, and the metaphor that came to me immediately, was it was like I'd been looking down the wrong end of a telescope all my life. And that all that happened in this experience was some kindly figure just sort of gently touched me on the shoulder and said, and turned the telescope round. And suddenly I saw through the right end, and suddenly I saw this vast perspective where everything was just all right. Everything was actually more than all right, it was perfect. It was perfect. And my instinct, I was just, oh dear, I've got all kind of upset and concerned about something that just isn't like that. I've got myself embroiled in this thing called life and got all kind of agitated, but I just misperceived it. I'd been looking down the wrong end of a telescope. And then the vision closed, as it were, and I was back to thinking, oh, nobody will think, see, people think my name isn't the right name, I'm not really friendly at all, and back to my usual neurotic self, really. So what I want to do is then just try and draw out, go back to those metaphors, those stories, and just draw out aspects of them which I think start to move us towards genuine spiritual experience. So let's go back first of all to my art school experience, to finishing that painting. The first thing that struck me about it, we're thinking about it now, it was the first time I experienced the Dharma, the meditation, but particularly the Buddhist vision of life, releasing my imagination. It moved me towards a direct appreciation of nature, the sheer joy and the sheer joy of creativity. At Goldsmiths in those days, all that had been rather frowned upon. We had to be very, very heady, very conceptual, very critical. The idea of just drawing some trees for the sheer love of it was really genuinely frowned upon, and it probably still is. But I had this fantastic experience of play, sheer play, doing these little coloured drawings, and the sheer joy of being able to make marks, and the marks, the magic of making a few marks and it becomes a tree. I got into that magic. I really felt that magic. I'd never tried to draw things before, and there they were, and I was just playing. I was just doodling almost. So it gave me this real sense of direct appreciation of nature and the sheer joy of creativity, the unleashing of energy that comes with genuine creativity. I also had my first stirrings of what I want to call animistic empathy. So I suddenly started to experience, in sitting in the park listening to Tristan drawing these pictures, that this little park was alive. And the trees that I were drawing were alive. They had characters. They had, as it were, characters. And when I transcribed them into my drawing, they just became characters on the page without me trying to make them into characters. I didn't think, oh look, they've got characters. When I looked at my drawings, each tree had got its own character, its own mood, its own atmosphere. It's as if it stirred this first sort of sense of empathy with natural life, a really genuine sense of that, not a cognitive one, but a genuine sense of natural life being alive from its own side, and having, as it were, its own atmosphere, its own character, so to speak. that experience was also linked with this rediscovery of classical music. I played the trombone when I was young. I played in the local orchestra, so I got to know classical music a bit. But when you play the trombone in the orchestra, you just count most of the time, and then you go, and then you sit down and wait for another loud bit, and then you go, that's all you do. So I don't particularly recommend it as an instrument. At least that's all I did. So it really woke, and just listening to Tristan, although I didn't understand Tristan at all at the time, it's now become, I think, probably one of my favourite operas, but I remember similar around this time, again, I'd been practicing meditating, I'd been practicing the Dharma, and we went on this bus tour to go and look at all these paintings, and I was lying on this bunk, listening on my Walkman again, to Fauré's Requiem, and there's a moment in Fauré's Requiem where the music, the accompaniment sort of falls in on itself, it's like falls into, and then this tenor voice sounds, and it's just one note. And it's as if the music slows and falls into itself, and then this one note of it keeps rising and rising, just this repeated note. It's exquisitely beautiful. And I was just slightly sleepy, lying on my bunk, and it hit me like a bolt out of the blue, this sound. It sort of broke my heart, as it were. It just opened me, my heart. A very physical experience of being released into a kind of ecstasy, just for a moment. Just this one note, this one sound repeated, took me into this sort of world of sort of ecstasy. So those are all some of the elements that were at play then, and I think they have sort of common features. The experience with listening to Fauré, the experience of the painting, seeing the painting, something in the painting that was more than me. So particularly, they've got the taste of something beyond themselves. So when I finished that painting, there was something in the painting that was beyond me, which fascinated me, which was both me and yet more than me, was both recognisable and yet strange, was both created out of the stuff of paint and uncanny. There was something that went beyond me, you know? Something beyond the me and mine. There was something meaningful that suddenly illumined the painting that I hadn't done. I didn't feel like I'd done it. It had come from, as it were, outside me. It had been a kind of magic. Then that experience of painting, of finishing the painting, is characterised by intensified interest and pleasure. So when I was working on the painting, I remember, you know, I was frustrated with it at first and the clumsiness of paint, and gradually just my interest, intrinsic interest with the problem of the painting, and a great sort of pleasure with working out the problem of the painting, intrinsic interest. So I wasn't trying to be interested, I wasn't thinking of myself as an artist anymore. I don't know whether anyone here has painted, but in the old days when I used to start painting, I'd immediately start having an interview with Malvin Bragg. And he'd say, yes, your recent work is strangely colourful. That's true, Malvin. You know, I'd always get into this interview thing. You know, I'd much rather have the show than actually do the paintings. But in this experience, it was characterised by intensified intrinsic interest. So I was actually interested in what I was actually doing, not in the result, not in being interviewed on the South Bank show, but in the actual problem I was trying to solve in the painting. Yeah? So intensified interest. My whole self was completely involved in it, completely taken by it. And that created this great sense of pleasure, yeah? A great sense of pleasure. A particular kind of pleasure, a particular species of pleasure that seemed to want to take me into the painting more and more. And then again, just to emphasise that there's this, a new element seemed to break in. When I got that bush right, when I moved it a tiny bit to the left, a new element seemed to break into the painting. I've also, about the same time, had an experience of that, as well as the Fauré experience. I had this experience of going to see a painting by Titian in the National Gallery, that this tutor that I really loved, and I still feel grateful to, she said, go and look at Titian. Again, nobody told you to do that. Goldsmith, it was terribly bad-mannered. So I went to go and look at this Titian, and I tried to look at it, and yes, it's a great painting, and I can tell you what the paint's made of, and so on. And, you know, I used to just try and talk it up in my mind, as you do, and try and have an aesthetic experience. Didn't do anything for me. And then one day I just came in by a different door and suddenly saw it without the machinations of thought. And again, I had this experience of it shattering me, of some kind of force coming out of the painting, or seeming to come out of the painting, which shattered me. So this sense of a new element breaking in, which at times can be extremely strong, even shattering. Yeah. All of these experiences evoked a very high level of connectedness. So when I was looking at that Titian, I mean, I'll never forget it. It was really uncanny. I couldn't ever explain it, but it was like the painting was as alive as I was. And as I looked at it, I became more alive, but spookily, strangely, uncannily, the painting became more alive. What usually happens in our life is we're a subject looking at objects out there, this dead world, and we're half dead ourselves, very often, at least I am. In this experience, the object seemed to be animated with some of the life of the subject. And I became, as it were, an object to the painting. I became something it was looking at. It's the most peculiar experience, absolutely exhilarating, and really rather strange. A sort of resonance, a new kind of, they call it intersubjectivity, where you feel that what's happening is you're in a world of subjectivities, and you're relating on that basis, rather than you looking at a sort of simple mark on a painting, on a canvas. It was as if I was seeing Titian's mind, because I couldn't say it was anything to do with the painting itself. It was almost as if, through all the marks that he'd made on that painting 400 years before, the force of his mind, his incredible genius of creativity, sort of arced across the room into mine and woke me up from a sort of slumber. Yes, and these experiences are complete. That experience, my experience of finishing the painting, my experience of Forward Requiem, they're complete experiences. They're not heady experiences. They're not intellectual experiences. They've got a thought element, but they're not cognized particularly. They're as much physical as they are imaginative. Yeah? And yes, they all galvanized my energy. So I think this then is our first task, I believe, is that we cultivate what I want to call the aesthetic imagination. Yeah? That a vital part of human life and a vital part of spiritual life is to cultivate an aesthetic imagination. I haven't got time to go into all the details of this. Just want to say one or two things and then I'll need to move on. But perhaps this might be something you could talk about in the group tomorrow. But one of the things the three things I'm suggesting is that, first of all, we cultivate or uncover animistic sympathy, animistic empathy. That we go out into nature and let nature come to us, cultivate Keats's negative capability, where he just sits and waits for nature, as it were, to make its impression on him, rather than irritably grasping out of facts, after facts, as he puts it, or something like that. Yeah. So cultivate animistic empathy. Go and feed, as Edwina was, to take the carrots, when you finish the ends of the carrots, as Edwina did, go and take them to the ponies. And by doing that, you'll start to cultivate empathy for nature itself. That's foundational to ethics. It's foundational, I think, to imagination. So it starts with a childlike empathy for the natural world. My little niece, I took her to show her the horse chestnut tree, because all the horse chestnut trees are ill. They've had this terrible blight, and they've had one blight or another. We're going to have, they think they're going to be decimated. They think it's the worst attack on a tree since Dutch elm disease. We'll have all these dead horse chestnut trees next year. So I took her to show her one, and I said, look, he's not very well. And I lifted her up into the leaves, and said, look, all the leaves aren't very good, and look, the conkers are much smaller. So we got to wish him well, and then we walked away, and she said, bye-bye, tree, hope you get better soon. And that's, in a way, what we need. We need to get back to that childlike sense of connectedness with the world, because that empathy, that feeling for the tree, is is the ground out of which not only ethics arise, but this aesthetic imagination arises. It's that sense of connectedness with the natural world which eventually matures into fully blown appreciation. So we really need to do that urgently, because we're increasingly alienated from it by our obsession with technology and with our living in cities. But enough already. The second one thing I wanted to suggest is that we improve our cultural diet. Try and read some decent things, try and look at some decent things. Not just, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And open ourselves to the beauty of art, to the beauty of nature, and take that seriously. It is a serious part of life. It's a serious part of spiritual life. It gives us a new kind of pleasure, without which we can't very easily make progress. Unfortunately, the arts has got so mixed up with imperialism, with all kinds of negative things, with class, with racial distinctions and so on. All of that has got mixed up with art, but that doesn't mean to say art is inevitably mixed up with those things. Yeah? So let's think of these qualities: play, a sense of meaning, absorption, intersubjectivity, pleasure, released energy, as being basically an expression of beauty. That when we talk about all these things, we're talking about beauty, really, an appreciation of beauty. And let's think of the beauty of beauty as being a lotus, a fully open lotus flower. Yeah. So let's now move on to my second story. I'll come back to the lotus in a minute. So my communication with Surta on that retreat, his looking at me, his attention to me, my response to that attention. And I think primary things shine out for me from his behaviour. As I say, I still feel grateful for that encounter now, so many years later. First of all, it's his non-reactivity and patience. So that when I said, I hate you, he said, why? And when I said, I want to go for a walk with you, and I'd been frowning at him all the time, he said, yes, let's go for a walk. Yeah. Non-reactivity and patience. Secondly, obviously, his kindness, a real sense of kindness, but not in any sense of patronising kindness, and not a touchy-feely kindness. He wasn't trying to sort of smooth me down, or kind of there me. It wasn't anything remotely like tea and sympathy. He's just given me, it was to do with the quality of his attention, the quality of his being, really, that sort of shone on me. A willingness to suspend judgments, a willingness not to opinionate and give advice. And then thirdly, I really felt his mindfulness. He felt very, very mindful of me. Not me as another retreatant, not even me as a young man, not me even me as a mixed up and happy young man, but me, myself, my individuality. I'm not a category like none of us are. I'm not this kind of person or that kind of person. There's just one of me, just as there's just one of you. And his mindfulness of that was directly palpable. And there's also this lovely sense of freedom. He just looked at me. He allowed me to have my experience. He didn't try to take it off me. He didn't try to rationalise it for me. He didn't try to package it up into some handy theory. He didn't come over with some well-meaning platitude, which I would have even then been repulsed by. He didn't try to fix me, he just looked at me. And the job was done by myself, as it were. Also his receptivity, he was very, very receptive. He listened to me. And not because he was practising his listening skills, by the way, something I'm, again, slightly allergic to. As when I give talks, you always hear all the things I'm allergic to at the moment. You get used to it after a while. He wasn't practising his listening skills. There was nothing professionalised about it. He was listening because he wanted to listen. And you can't train that. You have to practice many years to listen because you want to listen. Just as you have to practice many years to look at a painting because you just want to look at a painting for no other reason. Yeah. So he just listened to me. And the other thing I wanted to say is that he stuck around. He not only stuck around on the retreat, he was leading the retreat, but he's still there now. He still lives in Pamaloka now. He still teaches yoga. I've worked with him. I've been on retreat with him. I've talked to him many, many, many times. And what I find between us is the easy commerce of friendship. So I'm now 24 years older, or something like that, so I'm not very good at sums. he's not a father figure. He was a bit of a father figure to me then, but he's not now. And he's never been anything remotely like a therapist. We've carried along on the path together. And for me, his presence in the world, the fact that I know that he's also doing a retreat in Padmaloka just now, probably giving a talk just now, and probably not mentioning me. difficult to believe. That his presence in the world is a source of reassurance to me, a real source of reassurance. So this is our second task, to cultivate, to discover, and to keep rediscovering an ethical imagination. And I think this is what this anecdote exemplifies, is someone with an ethical imagination, the capacity to imagine into the lives of others, to see things from their point of view, to imagine and sympathise with their pleasure and pain. The Buddhist word for this is kalyana mitrata, which means beautiful friendship. The main meaning of the word kalyana is beautiful. So, and again, it shows you that ethical imagination is really another facet of aesthetic imagination. Your apprehension of value in your friend is aesthetic as much as anything else. So when we talk about imagination, we must be careful not to think it's always about art and images and painters, like I was. It's also about the way somebody looks at you, the way somebody reaches over to get the butter for you because you're in a silent period. Yeah? So let's think of ethical imagination. Let's think of a symbol for that. And the symbol I want to use is this one. This is a mala. So this is the symbol of a mala. So you think of it that the ethical imagination is this mala. Then you have to imagine that each bead of this mala is an individual man and woman. So that's Sibadramati, and then there's Jayaka, and then there's Suyen, and then there's Edwina, and so on. And I could go around the whole retreat, there's Vididharka, so on and so forth. Yeah, there's Jim. Every mala, every bead, is a person. And that you actually touch them. When you do your mala, when you do your mantra on your mala, you touch the mantra. You touch the person, so that every bead is a person, and that as you do the mala, every mantra can be from one person, and you, as it were, touch them physically and with your mind in each time. So let's think of the mala as being a symbol for aesthetic imagination. Yeah, aesthetic imagination. Do we want to have the door open? A little bit of air would be good. Would you mind opening the door? But this aesthetic imagination, this ethical imagination, has one more facet. So in a way, I think I'm just trying to talk about one thing, which we want to have to call imagination. Not the best possible word, because it suggests so easily image and creativity, and very much creativity, so-called creativity isn't really creative at all. But we have to make do with some kind of word. So I'm just trying to explore what imagination is, I think. And first of all, it has this ethical dimension, this aesthetic dimension, which we need to develop. It has an ethical dimension we need to develop. And it's got this third facet, which you could call value, illumination, insight. Yeah? So this brings me back to my glimpse of perfect vision on the night of my private ordination. So let's look again at that experience of my private ordination. As I said, it seemed to me to be a glimpse of how things really are. It didn't seem to be a glimpse of that. It was a glimpse of that. There's no doubting the veracity of your immediate experience at that depth. One can doubt one's narratives and so on. But this was an undeniable, complete experience, albeit short-lived. And it was an experience of, as I say, turning the metaphor that arose immediately after the experience was this metaphor of turning the telescope round the other way. And of course that's an image for the widest possible perspective, isn't it? Going from a narrow, tight perspective to the widest possible perspective. And that links very much to Jan of Archer's talk last night as being enlightenment living in the widest possible perspective. So in that moment, my small, narrow life that I was finding so painful suddenly was part of this vast pattern. And I was part of it, but only part of it, yeah? It was a little bit like, all my life I've been looking at this funny little shape or something, this funny little bit of stitching, which was me, and I was worrying about a little stitching, doesn't it look very good, and oh God, I wish it was nicer, and suddenly, in that moment, I saw this the whole tapestry, and so suddenly that little bit of stitching was part of this incredible tapestry. And I thought, you know, it really was this experience of, oh, I see. Oh, it's like that. It's very, very sort of simple, but at the same time incredibly profound. So that's the first sort of symptom of that, is that this incredible sense of perspective, of opening perspective. The second sense that I had immediately was the I can't even say the word. The words can't say anything about it. that words can't express it. Words can't describe it. In a way, that experience blew words away. Words were trivial, small, part of the small stitchwork of my little corner of my mind, not part of the universe. So any of those deeper experiences, they're characterised by the suspension of rattling thought. Yeah. And out of that, in that suspension, there's this incredible grace. This incredible grace. And the experience thirdly felt like both a completion of myself and the burning away of myself. I was both completed in it and transformed by it, or at least in that moment. And in a way, it feels exactly analogous to my painting experience. I had done these things, but then this new factor was there that overtook it, that overstepped it, that overtopped it. So it felt like the completion of myself, me at my very best, and yet nothing to do with myself at all. A wholly other vista. I became, as it were, the night sky, is how it felt. I became the tapestry for a moment, the whole tapestry. I was very struck by what Jan of Arc was saying about the microcosm and the macrocosm, the cosmos mirrored in the person. And it felt like that, immediately like that. It felt beautiful, blissful, and everything, as I say, felt perfect. Perfect, you have to be very careful with these sort of things, because only perfect at that level. Not at this level. What can happen is people say, oh yes, so everything's perfect, so we don't need to do anything. That's a wrong view, folks. It felt perfect at that level, and I can't tell you about that level, but at some level of reality, everything is just exactly as it should be, and couldn't ever be anything but. Yeah? But not at this level. So let's not get those levels mixed up. So let's call this experience of a glimpse of vision, of an opening perspective, let's call that the spiritual imagination. Yeah? The spiritual imagination. Or to use more traditional Buddhist language, let's call it Shraddha. Yeah, Shraddha, which means placing the heart upon. It's usually translated as faith, but it's rather a poor translation, really, because it evokes our kind of concerns with belief and dogma and so on. It's better to think of it as spiritual imagination, I think. And you could say it's characterised by a complete confidence in trust in value. There's no doubt about value, about the intrinsic meaningfulness of human life. There's no doubt about that. There's a direct, at its very highest, there's a direct apprehension of that. There's also a longing, when you're not in contact with that, there's a longing for value. A longing for value in all of its expressions. So a longing for genuine communication, a longing for meditation, a longing for friendship, a longing for beauty, a longing for meaning, a longing for ritual, a longing for a life well lived, a life that really does us justice. So it has this longing aspect. And it's also a direct experience of your potential. You suddenly see that you are also the whole tapestry. You're the whole of the night sky. That's your potential. You have the potential to be a Buddha, and you glimpse that. Not as a thought, not as a theory, not as a religious dogma, but as an actual transforming experience. Now, this experience I had, I just want to add a caveat, was a glimpse of that. I'm not claiming anything about it. The glimpse closed, the window closed, the door closed, and I was thrown back. I rediscovered myself in my usual, slightly neurotic way. But it was a glimpse, nevertheless. Shraddhar is then orientating the whole of your life to that glimpse, trying to live in accordance with that glimpse, so eventually that you can live in the whole tapestry, in the whole of the night sky, all the time. So that's Shraddhar, that's the spiritual imagination, a perception of values, truths and realities beyond self-clinging. Yeah, beyond self-clinging. The perception of values, truths and realities beyond self-clinging. And if we were to think of a symbol for it, we might think of the water-purifying gem. In traditional Indian Buddhism, there's this idea of the water-purifying gem, that all you need to do is you just put it into some muddy water, and it makes the muddy water go clean. So when you've got a very hot country where it hasn't rained for a long time, you could really do with a water-purifying gem. And they say that the spiritual imagination, the Shraddhar, is like that. It clarifies everything. It helps you see what your task of life is, what's really important, what isn't important, what's of real importance. It clarifies your perspective, your priorities, your human priorities. So you could call it the water purifying gem, or even the wish-fulfilling jewel. So the wish-fulfilling jewel would be that your deepest wish is to live that potential, to live in that kind of freedom that I glimpsed 20 years ago. Yeah. So it's only when these three facets of imagination are working together will the imaginative faculty be fully alive and mature. Without all three, you'll get into problems. So without the without ethical imagination, aesthetics becomes mere snobbery. It becomes the mere gratifying of ego. It can become art careerism. I saw an awful lot of art careerism when I was at Goldsmiths. No, I won't say that. But I did, honestly. I'm going to give you an example, but it's invidious. So you end up with that sort of art careerism. It ends up with snobbery, with ascetism, with elitism. In other words, what happens without the ethical imagination, and indeed without the spiritual imagination, the aesthetic imagination becomes to do with servicing your ego. It becomes another thing for you. It becomes something to make you feel special and arty. It becomes something to make you feel rather refined, rather cultivated and so on. In other words, it just becomes another gloss to your egotism. Without aesthetic imagination, on the other hand, ethics becomes ethical formalism. It becomes self-righteousness. It becomes do-gooding. It becomes mere social work. The thing I notice with people who I don't think have cultivated their aesthetic imagination enough is that they become peculiarly colourless. I don't know whether this has ever struck you. You meet some people, they're perfectly good people, very upright, very decent, very trustworthy, perhaps a tad conventional, but nevertheless a sort of upright citizen, but there's something incredibly colourless about them, bland about them. They don't seem to have come alive. Yeah? So I think that's one of the results of not cultivating this aesthetic imagination. And again, what happens, of course, is that ethics becomes, again, something that we do to gratify ourselves. It becomes another gloss on egotism. So it's to look good. It's to look as a good person, a kind person, and so on. One contemporary philosopher talks about sentimental emotion, and he says there's no such thing as sentimental resentment or sentimental spite, but there is such thing as sentimental grief, sentimental attachment, sentimental pity, sentimental love, even sentimental indignation. And that's because nobody will admire you for sentimental spite, if you see what I mean. Nobody admires it. But when we get into sentimental grief, sentimental pity, sentimental love, people will think that you're terribly big-hearted. Yeah? So this contemporary philosopher thinks that sentimental emotions are really just a showing off. They're really just to do with ego aggrandizement, albeit through an apparently ethical sort of vision. It's really to do with looking impressive in other people's eyes. But without the spiritual imagination, ethics and aesthetics are limited and immature. They sort of end up usually ossifying. Even some of our greatest poets, quite often what happens, I've been particularly struck by the life of Frost, Robert Frost, a poet at the time, I think, well, he's a great poet by anybody's definition. But as he got older, he just got more and more famous. He won the Pulitzer Prize 4 times. He just spent the last part of his life just getting honorary degrees from everywhere. But what happened is that his poetry got less and less great. There's this terrible falling off of the poetry and this incredible flowering of worldly success. It's one of the tragedies of his life, and a tragedy that must have haunted him. He must have been aware of it. So ethics and aesthetics will tend to fall back, will tend to ossify into egotism, will tend to become increasingly shallow. Only the spiritual imagination, integrated with ethics and aesthetics, helps us appreciate spiritual realities. At best, what you end up with without the spiritual imagination is you end up with a kind of refined egotism. The refined egotism of a connoisseur, really. Either an ethical connoisseur or an aesthetic connoisseur. And that's actually just egotism all over again. It's just as as inert, really, as egotism. So those three things, ethical imagination, aesthetic imagination, spiritual imagination, join together, don't they, into one great spirit in the world. And if we were to hold up the symbols I've suggested, so if we were to hold up the lotus, which is this image of beauty, this fully open lotus, white lotus as an image of beauty, if we were again to hold up a crystal mala, but one perhaps much, much bigger than mine, that can go round all beings in the universe, if we were to hold a jewel in our hand that expressed the spiritual imagination, and if we were to look at those three symbols for long enough, we'd find that they're held by a white figure. We'd find that as we look at them, as we looked at the open lotus, as we looked at the mala, as we looked at the jewel, we'd find that they're in the hands of the most beautiful figure we can ever have seen. A beautiful white figure, the colour of a conch shell. This figure is blushing with love. It's the colour of a conch shell, so he's white, if he is the right word, there's no denotation really. He, she is white, but blushing. So there's this tinge of pink all over the body, blushing, it's said, with love, and holding in one hand the mala, in another hand the lotus, and as if to say arms and hands aren't enough, develops 2 more arms and 2 more hands to hold between the palms of his hands the wish-fulfilling gem. And this, of course, is the radiant figure of Avalokiteshvara. He holds these three great symbols up to us. He holds them as offerings to us. He again appears well pleased. He's smiling. He has the most beautiful eyes. He looks upon us with almost scorching love. He looks upon us with this incredible tenderness that almost breaks our heart. He has these 4 arms. He's this white colour. And interestingly, he has this antelope skin over his shoulder, symbolising his enlightened sensitivity. So if you ever see deer, I saw them once on a retreat running through a wood, just these deer, about 3 deer running through a wood, and you couldn't hear a sound hardly. They seemed to float in this wood. They just were incredible, like this sort of dream thing. And they've got this exquisite, haven't they, tremulous sensitivity. So you imagine this antelope's incredible sensitivity, like the sensitivity of new snow, sensitive to the slightest sound. And yes, Avalokiteshvara holds up the lotus of beauty, the mala of ethical imagination, and the jewel of spiritual imagination. And if we look at them still more deeply, we realise, after all, what they are. We realise that the lotus is the great image for beauty. We realise that the mala is goodness. And we realise that the scintillating jewel he holds between his hands is truth itself. So there we have it, suddenly in front of us, held by the most compassionate figure in the universe, is the great triad that human life is always yearning for, moving towards, the triad of beauty, truth and goodness. And as we look at Avalokiteshvara, we see that all the figures have been doing this. All of the figures have been embodying and exemplifying these three great human values of beauty, truth and goodness. We look back at Tara, and we see beauty turn towards us, this ravishingly beautiful figure. We see the munificence of beauty, because Tara is giving, and we see the munificence of beauty. We look back at Kshitigarbha. We see him going down into the most hellish states of our mind and into the hells that we create around us. And we see the courage of beauty, sorry, the courage of goodness. We see goodness not shy of moving into the most difficult situations, whether it's emotionally and personally, psychologically, spiritually, politically, globally. Kshitigarbha is the courage of goodness, the courage of your convictions, the courage of your ethics. And then we look back at Vajrapani, and we see goodness again. We see goodness in its most energetic form. We see goodness as a fire burning around him. We see goodness breaking through into deeper levels of goodness, breaking through obscurations, through all the pettiness that separates us from goodness. Then we look at Manjugosha from last night, and we see this image of truth. We see the figure sitting in the sun, holding the sword of truth, holding the book of truth, who speaks the truth in this incredible voice. And again, with Avalokiteshvara, we have this figure of goodness, this figure of pure love, of compassion. So that when we look at these three symbols like this, we see all the images on the shrine change shape with each other, mix with each other. Kshitigarbha suddenly becomes Manjugosha. Manjugosha gives his sword to Avalokiteshvara. Tara goes down into hell. Kshitigarbha becomes a beautiful woman. They all shapeshift into each other. And then as we look at them, they all become the white light held in the jewel at the centre of Avalokiteshvara's hands. And when we look into that jewel, scintillating, illumined, constantly transcending itself, we see the mind of the Buddha himself. When we go into that jewel of the wish-fulfilling gem, which, as it were, is all of these figures that we've been looking at for these 10 days, all of them changing their natures, changing their colours, changing their implements, changing their foreground aspect, whether they're beauty in the foreground, or goodness in the foreground, or truth in the foreground, all of them disappearing again into that jewel. And as we gaze into the jewel, we see the mind of the Buddha. We see this mystery, which there are no words can express, no images can express, no concepts can express. In that seeing, we see the nature of reality itself. Thank you.